So I hear from your course with Mike Peskin, gauge couplings run. So I'm not going to say much about gauge unification, except it was one of the important features of the MSSM, that in the sense that it convinced many experimenters that supersymmetry was worth looking for, because the data on weak scale gauge couplings basically agree with the MSSM gauge coupling unification paradigm, whereas it doesn't agree with the standard model. So as you know, if we consider the running of with renormalization scale of, say, the third gauge coupling of QCD, there's some numerical constant in front. So this tells you the slope of how the QCD coupling, of what the QCD coupling is at any renormalization scale mu, and we match the renormalization scale mu onto the energy scale of the process, because we know that if you do that, you minimize higher order terms in, you know, higher loop terms, which are likely to be involve the logarithm of the energy scale you're considering over mu. So, the gauge, we can describe this gauge coupling from various sources, but one example is the free gluon coupling. So this is proportional to G3, the gauge coupling. And so the one loop corrections to this thing involve, for instance, diagrams like these, and this one. There's also diagrams involving ghosts. And fermions as well. Colored fermions. So you can see already that all of these diagrams, one loop corrections to the gauge couplings, are proportional to G3 cubed over 16 pi squared. 1 over 16 pi squared just comes from the loop integral. And each one of these couplings is proportional to G3. So we've got G3 cubed. This four-point gluon coupling is proportional to G3 squared. And the quark gluon coupling is also proportional to G3. So we sum all those diagrams, and we get, in the standard model, we get, you sum over all the fermion species that can be in there and so on, and you get B3 is -7, for instance, in the standard model. And so now what happens is you measure at LEP what these couplings are at some renormalization scale. So LEP's LEP did scattering at MZ. And even though formally the physics probabilities are independent with respect to whichever renormalization scale you choose, that's only when you sum them, all of the diagrams up to infinite order. If you truncate at like one loop order, then you have some residual renormalization scale dependence of your cross sections from the two loop and further on. And you know that they're going to involve terms. If there's only one energy scale in the process, they're logarithmically divergent, so they're going to involve terms of log energy over mu to some power n. And so if you set mu to the energy, you get a better approximation, even though you're only using one loop, because you're going to not introduce any large logarithms in the higher loop orders. So that's why the renormalization scale is fixed to the energy of the process you're considering. If there are several energy scales in the process in the scattering, then it's a lot more difficult and it's a lot less clear which energy scale you should pick if there's a large hierarchy between them. But in any case, so we do all this scattering at LEP at NZ, and we can fix the gauge couplings. Of the standard model there from experiment by measuring cross sections. And then you just you get numbers also for B2 and B1, and you just evolve them up, and they don't meet. Of course, there are errors on these things. The errors on G1 and G2, you probably couldn't see them on this diagram. There's a bit of fuzziness associated with G3, has slight now pretty tight errors on it. But there's no way within the errors that these things all meet. And as you know, in the grand unified paradigm, we only have, so for example, SU5 or SO10, there's only one gauge coupling, G5. And so if the idea is that this grand unified theory breaks via some grand unified Higgs mechanism to the standard model at a very high energy scale, what you should be seeing is you have a single gauge coupling and all of these guys meet at some renormalization scale, which is very high. And after that, they devolve together. Once you include the heavy states of the grand unified theory and the effective field theory, the X and Y bosons and so on. Okay, so, but of course, what was realized was actually when you have SUSY, there are additional diagrams which you have to include. So there are diagrams with gluinos in them. And in fact, squawks. So once you include these, the beta function, these numbers change for SUSY. So for example, in the MSSM, I remember beta 3 is -3 rather than -7. And so you can retry this exercise, and you find that to one loop and within the errors, that it works. And the gut scale is around 2, 10 to the 16 GV. And that scale has to be quite high, because the scale is matched to the order of magnitude scale of the gut particles, like the X and Y bosons, and they mediate proton decay. So the proton decay constraints are tight, and they tell you that actually, in fact, in minimal SUSY SU5, this is already pretty much ruled out by proton decay. In some of the other guts, it's not. Okay, so my own personal take on grand unification is that it's probably a little arrogant. Because what we're doing here is assuming that between the weak scale and the gut scale, we have supersymmetry times the standard model, and there's nothing else going on. That's a really big assumption. What you actually find typically is, for example, SUSY SO10, this can break actually through various ways. So you can Higgs it to the Putty-Salam gauge group at some intermediate scale, which then breaks to the standard model. There are many other possibilities. So this is called flipped SU5. And you know, who knows? There are loads of different possibilities. Maybe it's not as simple as grand unified theory. Maybe there's some string model, which, again, strings only have one gauge coupling, but that breaks, you know, the field theory limit of that is, you know, Patti Salam. Who knows? There's loads of different possibilities, of which this is only one. And actually, it's pretty. There are an infinite number of solutions to, you know, getting the gauge couplings to unify at the string scale. And it's an easy one to arrange. So this is a possibility, and it's kind of a fun, easy possibility. But my own take on it, which doesn't agree with most other people, is that I wouldn't take it too much to heart. I take that the supersymmetric solution to the technical hierarchy problem is a much more difficult problem to solve, and Susie does that very well. So for me, that's the main motivation for supersymmetry. So, as we know, as we've already said, the selectron mass is not equal to the electron mass empirically, for instance. It has to be much heavier, otherwise we would have seen it already. And in fact, you know, when we consider our corrections to the Higgs mass, from supersymmetric particles and their standard model counterparts, the change to the Higgs mass squared, the loop correction, goes like the scale of the Susie masses squared over 16 pi squared times some coefficient times lambda minus lambda rho squared. So these order one coefficients we know this thing on the left has to be less than or equal to something like the electroweak scale squared. And so we want, you know, from these kind of arguments, we want M Susie to be less than about one order of magnitude, a TV, so that we don't have to cancel them in order to get an overall Higgs mass squared that's fairly small, and get the electroweak scale of order 100 GeV. Are there any questions about this? I'm not sure I've been that clear. Okay.
So the unnatural cancellation is that you don't want the change in it, like the quantum change in the Higgs mass, to be bigger than what you think the Higgs mass already is.
Yeah, not too much, not like orders of magnitude bigger. So supposing we put in 100 TeV for these Susie particles, then, you know, each one of them would contribute 10 TeV to the Higgs mass squared. To the Higgs mass, sorry. And then you'd have to get them all to cancel to, like, one part in 100 in order to, such that to keep the Higgs mass down. Or cancel with the tree level value that you originally put in. And that's what you want to avoid. Yeah. But clearly, you know, there's no hard bound. You just get more and more uncomfortable as this thing gets higher and higher. So your sort of zeroth order hope might be that the cesium masses are about around the Higgs mass itself. But you know, LEP has probed around 100 GV, and they're not there. So they've got to be, the cesium masses have, some of them, the squawks and things, have to be heavier than like 300 GV. So this is starting to require a bit of cancellation in the electroweak symmetry breaking. Actually, I was going to talk about that as well. Okay, I wonder if now is a good time. No, it's not yet. Okay. Right. So it turns out we're going to see some examples of, well, we already saw how you might break SUSY with this F term breaking the O'Rafferty model. But it turns out you can't do that in the MSSM in a trivial way. Because spontaneous SUSY breaking via F-term or D-term breaking preserves the supertrace relation, which is supertrace of the mass squared of the particles, which is defined as sum over all the particles in a supermultiplet. Minus 1 to the twice times the spin plus 1 times 2j plus 1 times the mass of the particle squared is 0. Okay, you can prove that F-term breaking or D-term breaking preserves this relation. So if we apply that to, say, the photon, e.g. photon and photino, then what you get is minus 3 m gamma squared plus 2 m photino squared is 0. Okay, so photon mass, as far as we know, is 0. Empirically, we know it's tiny. And so this would predict a massless photino even after you've broken supersymmetry. So there's no way of giving a photino mass in if you break it directly in terms of F or D-term breaking. And you can consider the same thing for the squawks or something. Well, okay. I don't know. I mean, there's other supertrace mass relations between quarks and squawks and stuff. So we have to do something about this, and this is where supersymmetry gets baroque, to be honest. This is where the ugliness of the MSSM comes in. You see, before we break SUSY, when we've just got unbroken SUSY, n equals 1 global SUSY times the standard model, we have one less parameter than the standard model. And we have one less because we have all the same parameters, same masses, the same mixings, same gauge couplings, but there's one less in the Higgs sector, and that's because in the MSSM, the quartic coupling of the Higgs sector is related to the gauge couplings by supersymmetry, which you don't have, that's a relation you don't, you have a separate coupling in the standard model. So far it looks very nice, and then and now what we're going to do is break SUSY, and it's going to give us potentially a lot of extra parameters in the Susie breaking sector. But as I said, we can't break it directly. So what we do is we have to have the MSSM on one side, and we postulate a hidden sector of fields which are, so the hidden sector is defined by having some fields in it which are standard model gauge singlets. Okay, that means that they only interact gravitationally, or perhaps with our MSSM fields. And what we do is we do the F or D, we do the symmetry Susie breaking here in the hidden fields. Okay, the hidden sector will have this supertrace, will preserve this supertrace mass relation. But we don't care, because we don't observe, but haven't observed any of these anyway, apart from maybe dark matter. So there's some invisible fields, which, you know, some of which may be light, and we don't care. But then we need some interactions to mediate Susie breaking to the MSSM fields. So we kind of, it's like Susie breaking once removed. We break it directly in some other sector of fields, and then there's some interactions which bring the Susie breaking over to our fields. And, okay, this looks quite baroque, but it may be reasonable. I mean, in heterotic string theory, for instance, you have this group structure which comes out of E8 cross E8. So this direct product precisely means, you know, if the MSSM is a subgroup of this E8, then you'll have some other fields which are singlets under this E8 or MSSM, and that would form the hidden sector. So you do see structures like this coming out of string theories. And in string theory, when you have E8 cross E8, for instance, the mediation mechanism actually is gravity. So you always have gravitational interactions between all the fields. And so, in fact, supergravity can be the set of interactions that mediate between the Susie broken sector and the MSSM. So if you do this once removed Susie breaking, it turns out you don't have to preserve the supertrace relation on the MSSM fields, and we can make the scalars or the Susie particles heavier, for instance, and get around empirical constraints. So, examples of, actually let me give you an example of how Susie is broken in this setup in the hidden sector. So it's quite common, there are different ways of doing it, but this is a common example in string theory setups. And so we have some gauge group in the hidden sector, say, which is asymptotically free, so some subgroup of E8 or E8 itself. And we have some high energy scale, maybe it's the string scale. And now we consider a hidden gauge coupling, which has some value, perturbative value at the string scale. And this theory is asymptotically free, and it blows up. We have a Landau pole. Actually, this should be monotonic. at some intermediate energy scale lambda. So when you solve the renormalization group equations, so if this is you find that the scale of blowing up of the gauge coupling, where it becomes non-perturbative, has this solution. And so beta is some negative constant. Actually, that should be 16 pi squared. And so what you can see is that this lambda may well be exponentially suppressed compared to the initial mass scale you started with. So lambda can be much less than M string naturally, depending on the value of beta and the gauge coupling at the string scale. So when we get down to the strong coupling dynamics, what can happen in this Suzy gauge theory is that, so these are gauginos of the hidden gauge group of hidden sector. Gauge group. And when we get down to the strong coupling dynamics, it may well be that they condense in the sense that the product of two of them gets a non-zero expectation value. That contains a Lorentz scalar, so this doesn't necessarily break, or this it better not break Lorentz symmetry. Okay, this actually, I'm not going to go into any detail. This triggers Suzy breaking in the hidden sector. And it's called dynamical Suzy breaking. And it's like the canonical model from sort of string theory paradigms, if you talk about it. Okay, but as far we're kind of not aware. There's no way really, no easy way of testing how Suzy's really broken in this hidden sector. The thing that has an impact on our world that we can observe is this mediation mechanism, because the way that it's mediated determines the form of Suzy breaking takes in the observable fields, and that's the thing that we can, you know, measure at the LHC. So there's no single model of mediation. There are lots of different possibilities. Remember, we have the hidden sector. We have some interactions. And we have the MSSM. And the interactions may be supergravity or gravity, for instance. And they're suppressed by 1 over m Planck squared. So actually, what you get, the MSSM Suzy breaking scale is of order the fundamental Suzy breaking scale lambda squared over m Planck in this case. So this is going to give us the mass scale of the selectron. So if this thing is less than or equal to a TV, so that it doesn't give you too large a Higgs mass radiative correction. Oops. And lambda, lambda has to be root m Planck times TV. So you need to organize for lambda to be some intermediate scale between the Planck scale and the Wieck scale, 10 to the 11 GeV. In that case. But okay, and then another possibility, there are several actually. There's you could invent some new gauge interactions. New gauge interactions. Well, you have some fields, you have fields which are charged. Okay, so new interactions. So fields which are charged both under the standard model and they're charged under the standard model. And then there you get loops. So it's really these interactions. It's really gauge interactions then, and the mediating force. Standard model gauge interactions mediate the Sisley breaking. And this is called gauge mediated Sisley breaking. So, you invent some new fields. So like, for instance, you have a standard model squawk, which gets some loop corrections from some of these additional fields. Perhaps I better not draw it because I'll just get it wrong. Sorry. So here's a two-loop diagram involving these additional fields phi. They've got proper Sisley breaking in them, and they transfer it to the squawks through diagrams like this. There's no direct interactions with the squawks, but through via standard model gauge interactions, they transfer it. And then there are like two or three other possibilities for this mediation as well. And then in this case, the selectron mass or some squawk mass is given by the fundamental Sisley breaking scale, just divided by a loop. So the mass squared is a two-loop effect for the scalars here. So the mass is a one loop effect. So this means that you expect lambda to be something like 100 TV, a loop factor times TV. So this has much lighter fundamental Sisley breaking scale. And in fact, that's fine. It has a light gravitino. Usually, in gauge mediated Sisley breaking, gravitino is the LSP, turns out. Okay, so those are just some examples. So what I want to do now is just tell you in general what CZ braking can add to the Lagrangian. We've seen the superpotential of the MSSM. We know how to construct the gauge terms, the gauge interactions. So I'm going to give you the R parity conserving CZ braking terms that you get when you go through this kind of procedure. And there's a bunch of them. So we have some trilinear scalar couplings, which are called A's. So I'm going to put family indices in as I and J, but I'm going to neglect all the gauge indices because it'll just make it too much of a mess. So we add gauge invariant, R parity invariant, Lorentz invariant terms that can be generated by this kind of setup. Okay. So these are trilinear scalar interactions, all these top terms. Then we have some additional masses. Or the squawks and the slaptons. You're right. So I should write indices on this. I and J. J. So these are CZ braking masses for squawks and sleptons. So that's good. So these are the parameters that are going to make the squawks and sleptons heavier than we've already seen. And then we have some CZ braking masses for the Higgs doublets. And there's an additional CZ braking term for the Higgses. This B parameter. And then there are some Majorana masses for the Gaugenos. So the Gluinos, the Wienos. And hypercharge beamers. So that's that's the effect. In general, that's the effect of these CZ braking terms. Now, that looks horrendous, and it is. There's over 100 parameters here. Well, getting on for 100 parameters in general, which is nasty. Yeah.
I know that there are superfields, but do these lead to mass terms for the gauge bosons?
These aren't superfields.
Oh, I see.
So these are the component fields.
So this is how do you get a renormalizable gauge theory, the massive bosons?
These are the spinner half components.
Oh, I see. So,
So it's not yeah. So the
super partner.
The yeah the super partners, not the gluons or whatever.
The gauge bosons can have masses?
No, the gauge bosons are massless still.
Right, so yeah, I see. So, right. Yeah, I see.
So this looks very bad, but actually when you, this is like a general phenomenological parameterization of what you can have. And when you set a specific model down of Susie Brake mediation, you know, maybe within a string context or something, what you find is there are the relations between all of these parameters. In fact, very often, all of these scalar masses are just equal to one parameter times the identity matrix. Yes. The vast, if you just write this phenomenological parameterization, the vast majority of it's ruled out. And that's because of these flavor mixing terms, the off-diagonal terms in this mass matrix will give you huge flavor-changing neutral currents, which is ruled out. So in fact, you need something you need something that's proportional to one in family space, approximately proportional to one anyway. And you know, if you're coming from string theory or you have some Susie gut, then actually you're going to relate all the gauge, all the gaugino mass parameters, often too. And often, in fact, you'll also find that the trilinear scalar couplings are just proportional to the Yukawa coupling times some single parameter as well. So it may not, and in string theories there are even relations between, sometimes in string theory setups, there's like factors of root 2 in between these parameters and stuff. So it may be that you only have one or two extra parameters, but if you just parameterize it in general, it looks like you've got hundreds. So this case, yeah.
The string theory sources, do they come from the landscape like flux models in string theory?
That's one example. But you can, people mess about with D-brain setups.
Right, right.
They originally, you just did this gaugino condensation and used right. Supergravity mediation. There's loads of different possibilities.
But that introduces the problem called modular function,
right? But you always have that problem anyway. You can have this no scale supergravity that, well, you really always have the cosmological constant problem because you've got, associated with chiral phase transition anyway. So there's an important kind of subset of this phenomenological parameterization that you should be aware of because a lot of analysis has been done on it. So it's kind of it's where you have this list of parameters. So we call all of the gaugino masses equal to m a half. We have A0 as the trilinear coupling degree of freedom. And it's called, people originally called it minimal supergravity. Okay, because they thought, well, gravity ought to be flavor blind. So, we'll just make sure that the masses and stuff are all flavor blind. But then they realized that when you actually write string theory models of supergravity and stuff, that's not actually true always. I mean, it depends on the setup. So some other people said, that's wrong, really. That's the wrong nomenclature. We should call it the constrained MSSN, or U. And so you'll hear it being called either of those two things. And it has parameters, so it has a scalar mass, M0, has a Gugino mass m½. It has a single trilinear coupling, A0, trilinear scalar coupling. And in fact, I should point out Higgs masses are also set to this mass parameter. And there we always have this parameter tan beta left, which is kind of intrinsically MSSM, intrinsic MSSM parameter associated with the two Higgs doublets. It's the ratio of the two Higgs VEFs. Now you'll notice that I haven't said anything about this parameter, or this one in fact. And actually, mu and b are fixed by a combination of, are fixed by MZ and the electroweak symmetry breaking conditions. So these conditions are where you minimize the Higgs potential and you get some relationship between these parameters and MZ and these parameters and tan beta. So that fixes, these are fixed for you. Typically, that's what people mean.
What scale is this? What scale are all the masses the same?
Huh?
What scale are all the scale masses the same?
Yeah. So, about, yeah. Okay, so.
My question was, at what scale are all the masses the same?
No, I'm about to tell you. So actually, you know, this is only going to apply at some high scale where you have something akin to a string theory or grand unified theory. Because below that, you know, there's a difference between the QCD and the electroweak interactions. And so what happens is, say, let's call it grand unified scale or M string, something. We don't know. So this is a logarithmic scale on the abscissa. And we have mass. So if we consider m½ here, so we can actually all of these parameters evolve with renormalization scale, just like the gauge couplings do. And you can calculate what their renormalization group equations are. They're complicated and they all involve each other and stuff. But you can use, there are computer programs, for example, I've got one called SoftSUSE, which does this renormalization group evolution for you. They're available on the web. And what happens is that this single mass parameter here receives loop corrections which split it up into the individual M1, M2, and M3 when you evolve down with energy. And all the scalar mass parameters also split up. So this might be a squark mass, for instance, whereas this might be a selectron mass. And it's the same deal for the trilinear scalar couplings. So there's a special case I need to mention here, and that's the Higgs mass parameters. So the Higgs mass squared overall total for the Higgs. So let's consider H2. It actually gets two contributions. One of them is this mu term, which is SUSY preserving. This comes from the superpotential term. And this one is the SUSY breaking term. H2 squared. And there's an equivalent thing for H1 squared, okay? So, you know, the mass of say H2 isn't really, doesn't start at M0. It starts at root M0 squared plus mu squared. And what happens is this thing evolves with energy, but it has negative contributions from the top quark. And they pull it down very sharply, and it becomes negative here. So there are, you know, it gets pulled down by the top Yukawa coupling corrections to the RGU. So in other words, you consider, say, H2. There's a very large dominant correction to its mass. Which is negative, and or to its mass squared, and its mass squared actually becomes negative at the electroweak scale, near the electroweak scale. And it's that thing. Remember, when you have a Higgs potential with a negative mass squared, the Higgs mechanism kicks in. So this triggers electroweak symmetry breaking. So we build a model that initially, you know, at high renormalization scales, short distances, it's got the electroweak symmetry intact. And then via these quantum corrections, radiatively at larger distances, we see electroweak symmetry breaking kicking in. And so this is a radiative effect, and it's called, so it's a nice feature of the MSSM. And it's called radiative electroweak symmetry breaking. Yeah.
So is the y-axis mass squared?
Sorry?
The y-axis mass squared or just mass?
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, I can't say it becomes negative here. It becomes imaginary.
Right.
Yeah, either way. Yeah. So, yeah, that's right. So if you ever get involved with phenomenological analysis, there are four codes that do all this for you. So there's SoftSUSY, which I encourage you to use, because I wrote it. Suspect, SVNO, and it is a SUSY. You can look those up and you can download the codes and use them. Okay. All right. So all I want to do now is summarize. We haven't had much detail on the MSSM. There's a lot more to it. Its phenomenology is really complicated, actually, especially when you're looking at collider events. There are literally thousands of papers, probably 10,000 written now, and there's still more to do. There are just many different possibilities for it. So let's write down some pros and cons of the MSSM. So, one of the cons, are the order 100 extra parameters in SUSY breaking sector. But as we've seen, you know, this may not be a problem because there may only be a couple of extra ones. There are, as I mentioned, there are many restrictions on these from experiment, particularly flavor physics. And then there's a problem associated with the mu term. Remember, the superpotential added this term, H1, H2. And for the Higgs to have a mass of order the electroweak scale, we need mu to be of order 100 GeV as well. Remember the Higgs mass squared gets contributions from mu and this MH2. And so if it's like M gut, then you're not gonna predict the right Higgs mass. But you see, this has nothing to do with, or like it's not generated by electroweak symmetry breaking. We could put in M Planck for this, and this term doesn't violate any symmetries of the standard model. And so the question is, why is mu much less than M Planck? Okay, so that's one problem. There are solutions to that. So in fact, all of these cons can be solved with further model building. On the pro side, the big pro for me is it solves the technical hierarchy problem. That's a really difficult problem to solve, and I think it's the only explicit perturbative solution that is really satisfactory that's been so far found. There may be other ones. Okay, another one that people normally call a big pro is gauge coupling unification. It's nice to have a dark matter candidate already in the model kind of for free. You don't have to add an extra one. Radiative electroweak symmetry breaking is a nice feature as well. Okay, so thanks a lot for listening. I enjoyed very much giving these lectures and all your questions and everything. It was a lot of fun.
It's not the same teacher. Everyone gets a different teacher.
Oh, nice. Thank you. Thanks very much. Cheers.